Good mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, the annual Medicare open enrollment period begins in exactly 3 weeks. We'll tell you what recipients need to know about changes to the program ahead of making those decisions for 2025. Also this morning, one of the many food and nutrition initiatives supported by the Farm Bill is the innovative Farm to School program. It's the perfect example of a project that benefits all involved. We'll learn more. In case you missed it, we have a recap of yesterday evening's forum between the two candidates vying to be the next Hancock County Common Pleas Court judge. And there are lots of ways to enjoy the autumn season with programs and activities from the Hancock Park District in October. Michelle Rumschlag will be here to tell us what's happening. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Tuesday, September 24th, 2024. Autumn is here, and I don't know if you've noticed some of the leaves already starting to turn. Of course, we're a long way off from the peak fall colors, but love this time of year to go out and see the fall foliage and all of that. The Ohio Department of Natural Resources says that Ohio residents can now use the popular mobile app Outer Spatial to guide your fall foliage hikes this coming season. Hiking trails throughout state parks and nature preserves and wildlife areas have been added to the app as of earlier this year. Users can access trail maps across the state by joining the Ohio Community tab within the Outer Spatial platform, Outer Spatial. It is available for Apple and Android devices. So if you want to go out and catch the fall colors and go on for a hike, you'll have to check that out. So just another way to find your next fall adventure. Happen to see that this morning. Among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, it is the end of an era. This probably will not come as a big shock unless the surprise is, I can't believe that there was one of these still open. That may be a bit of a surprise, but it says here, the last full-size Kmart store in the United States is closing its doors. And again, no big shock here unless you didn't even realize that there still was a Kmart store around. Yes, one. Exactly one of them. It is in Bridgehampton, New York, and it will be closing for good in less than a month. October 20th is the last day. So, if you want one more excursion to Kmart, get to Bridgehampton, New York before October 20th. Now, there is, I guess, a smaller Kmart store in Miami that is still operating, but it is more along the lines of like a convenience store than a big box retailer. So it's not anything like the Kmart that you remember. But it is a very enigmatic end to a once great retailer. You know that Kmart at one time had 2,300 locations. In the United States, 2,300 locations, and now they're down to one, and in less than a month, it will be exactly zero big box stores left. So the blue light special would be relegated to the dustbin of history. It's kind of like, it is a bit bittersweet. It's kind of like when you hear Blockbuster Video, the last Blockbuster Video is closing. They still have a something tells me that I remember hearing the last Blockbuster Video is closing. Maybe it's still around. I don't know. But, you know, it's that kind of thing. You know, something that was at one time such a ubiquitous part of American culture to just disappear like that. The last dying gasp of Kmart. Now, they do have Kmart stores. They're still relatively popular in some territories like Guam. And I think the Virgin Islands still has some. Anyway, but in the mainland, in the country, the 50 U.S. actual states. Nope. Last one is closing. Speaking of nostalgia, how about this? Apparently, the Tamagotchi is coming back. That iconic 90s toy, the electronic pet, the Tamagotchi, is making a comeback. Demand was so high last year, beginning in 2023, that Namco, Bandai Namco, the creators of the Tamagotchi, they opened their first brick-and-mortar store in the UK this year, apparently just to sell the Tamagotchi, the virtual pet store. The handheld toy lets you care for your virtual pet. Newer versions have some upgrades, like the ability to play on Wi-Fi and download items, I guess, for your pet. Some stylish influencers have even been seen sporting Tamagotchis as keychains. Some older players are in it for the nostalgia, as one woman by the name of Emma, who I guess posts about her adventures with her virtual pet on YouTube. With how the world is at the moment, she says, and how it has been for the past few years, it's nice to just look down at your little pixel pet every now and then. It's a reminder of a simpler time. Or you could go even simpler and get an actual pet. But I get it. I understand. It's something especially for millennials. It's very nostalgic. It's kind of a comfort thing. So, millennials rejoice. Tamagotchi is back. Wow. There is nothing new in the world. It's just recycling all the old stuff. Again, not that that's a bad thing, I guess. And I understand where this woman is coming from when she says, with everything that's going on in the world, it's a reminder of a simpler time. By the way, speaking of everything going on in the world, here's the latest on the presidential election. Crazy story. Vice President Kamala Harris will apparently be skipping the Archdiocese of New York's 79th Al Smith Memorial Foundation dinner, which is happening on October 17th. I don't know if you know about the Al Smith Memorial Foundation dinner, but apparently this is a tradition in election years, especially for both presidential candidates to attend the dinner, which is named after New York's former governor. And what they do is they take turns roasting each other. It's all in good fun. But the candidates will roast each other. It's a moment of levity in the middle of the campaign. But Kamala Harris says she's going to skip it this year. The campaign says she will instead have rally events in key battleground states as a last push leading up to the final 2 weeks before the election. A spokesman for the New York Archdiocese, Joseph Zwilling, says that former President Trump has confirmed that he will be there. And he said, or his campaign said, that they hope Harris will reconsider, and the Archdiocese is hoping that Ms. Harris will reconsider. The last time that a presidential candidate ducked the annual charity dinner, by the way, raises money for New Yorkers in need, so it's a charity thing. The last time that a presidential candidate ducked out of the annual event was Walter Mondale in 1984. And it worked out so well for Walter Mondale in 1984. So maybe the vice president might want to actually reconsider and attend the 79th Al Smith Memorial Foundation dinner. Again, this is an annual thing, but it takes on added significance during an election year, and the two presidential candidates will take good-natured jabs at each other. But I can understand why she might be hesitant to do that, because Donald Trump's jabs, good-natured jabs, often aren't quite so good-natured. So I can get it, but like I said, the last time a presidential candidate didn't show was in 84. Walter Mondale didn't do so well. I'm not sure that's why he didn't do so well, but it couldn't have helped. And less because he didn't win New York in 1984. So maybe it did have something to do with it. He actually even lost New York to Ronald Reagan that year. Anyway, and that may have been the last time that a Republican presidential candidate won in the state of New York. I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up. But doesn't happen very often, to be sure. And lastly, here among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. Speaking of New York, I thought this was interesting. A new study, which shows that, and it's a Wallet Hub study, shows that the priciest city in the U.S. to retire in is New York City. The priciest city in the U.S. to retire in. More expensive even than Honolulu, Hawaii, which was number two on the list. So think about this. It is more expensive to retire to New York City than it is to go out 2,000 miles away from the nearest landmass. And it is less expensive to go out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean 2,000 miles away from anything and get a house out there and retire. It would be more cost effective to do that than to live in New York City. You think about it in those terms. It says, Wallet Hub says, if you want to retire to the city that never sleeps, it'll cost you about $4,500 for an average one-bedroom apartment in New York City. $4,500. Honolulu, number two for the priciest retirement destinations. Boston is third. Seattle is fourth. And Yonkers, New York, is fifth. And then the rest of the top ten, Santa Rosa, California, Bridgeport, Connecticut, San Francisco, and Fremont, California, are tied for eighth place. Jersey City, New Jersey, in ninth, and Burlington, Vermont, in tenth place. Now, again, those are the ten priciest locations to retire in the U.S., retiree tax friendliness was considered, as well as housing costs, to compile the list. But here's the thing, and I love Wallet Hub's lists. Generally, they're pretty interesting. But of all of those places, how many of them would you actually want to retire in? I don't know too many people who are saying, you know what, I'm going to retire, and I just can't wait to move to Yonkers. You know, I don't know that many of those places. That nobody's saying, I want to retire to Jersey City. Maybe Vermont, I guess, if you love the snow. But, you know, I don't know how many of those places you would actually want to retire to. But if you do, maybe make some alternate plans. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Tuesday morning started here.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchak. Your WTOL 11 weather. Showers likely today, a high in the mid-70s. Showers possible tonight, a low in the lower 60s. Findlay Police Officer Paul Fry and K-9 Officer Axel recently completed a five-week K-9 handler training class, and they are now a certified K-9 team for the Findlay Police Department. K-9 Axel replaces K-9 Shadow, who retired last month after 13 years of service with the Findlay Police Department. Officer Fry has been with the Findlay Police Department for more than 5 years, and Axel is a 17-month-old male German Shepherd from Germany. Axel is trained in obedience, building search, area search, criminal apprehension, tracking, article search, and narcotics detection. Officer Fry and Axel will be available on duty during their shift and also available to assist other law enforcement agencies as needed. See a picture of the two in this story on our website. The Portage County Board of Elections has removed the County Sheriff's Department from security detail at the board office during early in-person voting.
This after Sheriff Bruce Zukowski urged residents to write down the addresses of neighbors with signs supporting Kamala Harris. In a statement on social media, board member Randy Kleit says, quote, I feel strongly it is in my responsibility to make sure I do what is in my authority to make sure every voter in Portage County feels safe casting their ballot for any candidate they choose.
ONN's Russ Mitchell reporting. The Findlay Service League has launched its service year and is accepting requests for volunteers and funding. Nonprofit organizations are eligible to request volunteers or funds for projects and events happening between September 2024 and April 2025. Get more details in the story on our website. A dedication ceremony was held for the Bluffton Lions Way State Route 103 pathway. Officials say the pathway's construction represents a major improvement to the corridor entering the village, connecting numerous food vendors near the I-75 State Route 103 interchange with the village of Bluffton. Get more details in this story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
Well, as the Medicare annual enrollment period approaches, in less than a month, we'll be into that window again. Millions of Americans will soon be making crucial decisions about their health care coverage for the next year. And joining us this morning to talk about what's new, what you need to know, is the Chief Consumer Officer of Medicare Advantage at United Healthcare, Betsy Chin. And Betsy, when is the annual enrollment period? Talk a little bit about why this is such an important time.
Absolutely. Yeah. As you mentioned, the Medicare annual enrollment period is just about a month away. It begins on October 15th and runs through December 7th. And this is a crucial time of year for anybody with Medicare coverage because it is the one time each year when you get a chance to look at how your plan may be changing for next year and decide if you want to stay in that plan or if you want to make a change before 2025.
So this is especially important for those who are currently have a Medicare Advantage plan or those who are considering one. Let's talk a little bit about the different types of Medicare that are out there.
So first, there's Original Medicare, which is Parts A and B, and that comes directly from the federal government and helps cover things like inpatient stays at hospitals or doctor's visits and other outpatient care. Then there's Part C, also known as Medicare Advantage. And Medicare Advantage are like an all-in-one plan. They combine Parts A and B into a single plan and often also include Part D, which is prescription drug plan, as well as extra benefits, things like dental, vision, and hearing coverage, a fitness benefit, maybe even transportation. So that's your Medicare Advantage plan. Think of it as sort of the all-in-one plan, combining A, B, and D into a single plan, plus some extras. For those who want just prescription drug coverage as a standalone, Part D plans are available on their own as well. That's a good option for people who choose to stay in Original Medicare but want prescription drug coverage. And then the final option is Medicare Supplement coverage, also known as a Medigap plan. This is a type of coverage that helps pay for the costs that Parts A and B don't cover. So things like coinsurance or copayments. So lots of options out there, whether you're in Original Medicare with a Part D plan or a Medicare Supplement plan with a Part D plan, or you combine all the coverage into a single Medicare Advantage plan. It's important to do your homework, think about your health needs, your budget, and find the plan that's right for you.
So obviously a lot of different options there, a lot of different possibilities. What are some of the things that people need to be thinking about right now in order to make the decision that is best for them?
I would encourage people to think about three things. First, think about your health needs. What doctors do you like to see? What types of conditions are you managing and what kind of prescriptions do you take? Those factors are going to have a very big impact on what kind of coverage is right for you. So think first about your healthcare needs. Next, think about your budget. Each type of Medicare coverage that I mentioned has different costs associated with it. So it's important to think about what type of coverage you can afford and whether you like to pay upfront in terms of a premium or you would rather pay as you go with copayments or coinsurance. And then finally, think about the types of benefits that are important to you. All Medicare plans will cover some amount of hospital coverage and doctor visits, but only some plans cover that prescription drugs and extra things like dental care or vision care, hearing, fitness, etc. So think about your health needs, your budget, and the types of benefits that you want, and that will help you narrow down which type of Medicare plan is right for you.
Now, we have heard an awful lot about changes to the Part D prescription drug coverage portion of this that you were mentioning earlier because of the Inflation Reduction Act. How will that impact people on Medicare and specifically those who have a Medicare Advantage plan that includes the prescription drug coverage?
Yeah, a couple of things for people to know about changes to the Part D program this year as a result of the Inflation Reduction Act. First is that the coverage gap, also known as the donut hole, is gone. So that's good news for people. There's no longer that gap in coverage that was referred to as the donut hole. Mm-hmm. That's gone. Second piece of good news as a result of the Inflation Reduction Act is that the out-of-pocket maximum has been lowered. So this year, the out-of-pocket maximum for people with a Part D coverage is $8,000. Next year, it's reduced all the way to $2,000. So a nice price protection for people as a result of the Inflation Reduction Act. I would just encourage people, though, to still check your coverage. There is some good news, like I mentioned, with no more donut hole and some better price protections.
Right.
But other things on your plan can change as well. So do your homework. Make sure that you still look at the formulary, still look at your network, and look at any other costs associated with your plan as you head into the new year.
I guess that was really what I wanted to focus on or wanted to get to is that even though these are, you know, positive developments, positive improvements to the program, people shouldn't discount the coverage for prescription medication. It's still something that you want to take a very close look at.
Yeah, you should, because the formulary, which is the list of approved drugs that your plan covers, can change every year. The costs, like premiums and deductibles, co-payments, co-insurance, those can change every year as well. So even with the good news coming from the removal of the donut hole and the lower out-of-pocket maximum, it's still important to do your homework and make sure you know the total cost of your plan for next year. And if it's not going to work for you, there's lots of other options out there to explore as well.
And again, just to underscore what we were saying, we're about a month away from the opening of the enrollment period. So it may seem like we've got plenty of time to think about this, that it's not really urgent, but that window is relatively short and you don't want to be making these decisions hastily at the last minute. You definitely want to start now so you can take your time.
That's right. I encourage people to start thinking about it soon. Take your time, do your research. And before we know it, we're in the throes of the holiday season and, yeah, and life becomes really busy. So start your research now so you feel prepared to make a decision before December 7th, which is the end of the enrollment period.
Yeah, that too. It's not like this is not going to already be a busy time. Betsy Chin is Chief Consumer Officer of Medicare Advantage at United Healthcare. Where do we get more information?
For more information, I encourage you to visit MedicareEducation.com.
Betsy, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
So you may remember yesterday on the program, we were talking about the delay passing a new farm bill. It was our cover story on the program yesterday. If you missed our conversation with Ed Lentz, we were talking, new farm bill was actually supposed to be passed last year, and they didn't get it done. And then they were going to do it this year, and they haven't gotten it done. And now it looks like it may not be done until next year, if then, and Ed was talking yesterday, that there are some doubts as to whether even next year. You know, we've had delays in passage of a new farm bill. It's a massive piece of legislation. There have been delays in this before, but a two-year delay is pretty extreme. And so we're talking about some of the concerns over kicking this critical can down the road even further. If you missed our conversation with Ed yesterday about these concerns, it was really interesting to go back to the podcast and listen, kind of catch up on what you missed, the podcast from yesterday. But I thought this was pretty timely with that conversation, considering that National Farm to School Month and National School Lunch Week are coming up in the month of October. Both of those are programs that are funded via the Farm Bill. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture is out there promoting these programs, joining communities across the nation and recognizing the benefits of healthy, locally grown foods in school meals and celebrating the dedicated people who make it possible. Again, this is one of those programs that's funded through the Farm Bill, supported through the Farm Bill. So with that in mind, and this is really, especially the Farm to School program, is a perfect example of a project that benefits all involved. It's a win-win-win. It's a win for the farmers. It's a win for the schools. It's a win for the students. And we are joined this morning by USDA Deputy Undersecretary of Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, Cindy Long. Cindy, explain, for the benefit of those who don't already know, explain what the Farm to School program is and why it is so important.
Well, thanks for that opportunity. You know, on an average day, about 30 million kids eat a school lunch or breakfast. And, you know, we know that thanks to the great work of school nutrition professionals, those meals are already among the healthiest that kids can obtain. And a big part of that is all the work that has already happened to bring more fresh local foods into these programs. And that's what we're celebrating during Farm to School Month and National School Lunch Week. These programs work in so many different ways. Farm to School programs can encompass anything from, you know, a school garden or a school greenhouse, to a partnership with a local producer or producers where they come into the schools and teach kids about how to garden or how a particular item grows. And it can include bringing kids into the food preparation process, right? It can mean using a local food and creating a snack in the classroom or a taste test or even bringing it into the cafeteria. Mm. And all of these things together help teach kids about food, about where it comes from, and that helps support healthy habits, which will serve them for a lifetime.
As you mentioned, this is a program that can take many different forms. What is the USDA doing to support schools in operating these programs?
Well, USDA is really all in on supporting school meals in every way that we can. We have provided billions of dollars in various types of financial support since January of 2021. With respect specifically to supporting local foods and farm to school, we have provided almost $180 million directly for the purpose of schools purchasing fresh local foods and incorporating them into their school menus, which, by the way, is a win-win not only for the quality of school meals, but also as a form of expanding markets and economic support for local producers and growers.
Sure.
We have also provided hundreds of farm-to-school grants to individual schools and local community organization, again, to forge those ties and to support that programming, whether it's school gardens or whether it's taste testing. Really just schools have a lot of ability to tailor it in a way that meets their needs. But the common theme is helping kids understand where their food comes from and developing a positive relationship with food.
Yeah. Now, with respect to that, and you were mentioning earlier, the goal is to help kids develop good eating habits moving forward. How do these programs do that?
Well, you know, we all know that kids aren't programmed to eat well, right? They have to learn how to do that. And all of these activities that we've been talking about, you know, these hands-on engagement that help kids learn about their foods, that help them understand where it comes from, that it comes from a garden or a farm, not the grocery store. Mm. And having kids participate in the process of working with food, all of those things teach them healthy habits, and they learn that food can be healthy and still taste good.
Now, for all of the great work that these programs do within the school structure, what role do parents play in all of this?
Well, parents play a huge role, obviously. And the first thing I always suggest to parents is go to your child's school and share a school lunch or breakfast with them. Talk to them about the importance of eating well and how they can do that both at home and school. And then at home, there are a variety of ways to bring the same kind of lessons into your home process. that can include experimenting with a new food, maybe something your kid tried for the first time at school, maybe even a local food. Allow them to take part in preparing meals. You know, even the youngest kids can wash fruits and vegetables, and be part, as they get older, they can be more and more part of the process. And that, again, anything that makes them part of the process and connects to food is part of developing healthy eating habits.
Again, as we mentioned, the month of October, we observe National School Lunch Week. We know the importance of school lunches, and even more significantly, because this is relatively new, I think, for a lot of folks to hear about, is the National Farm to School Month observance as well, I guess, for lack of a better term. We are joined by Cindy Long, USDA Deputy Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services. Where do we get more information on all of this?
Well, a great place to start is our website, which you can find at fns.usda.gov/schoolmeals. That'll give you information about the program in general, and you can also find information about farm to school and local foods from there.
It is a program that has been embraced at schools across the country, including in our area, making healthy habits a part of the everyday routine for kids. And Cindy Long, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
So in case you missed it yesterday evening, WFIN and the Findlay-Hancock County Chamber of Commerce hosted a candidate forum between the two individuals who are vying to be the next Hancock County Common Pleas Court judge. It was a little bit different than some of the past forums that we've held. When you have candidates for a traditional public office, you can ask about issues and how they would, you know, manage certain legislative items, that kind of thing. Talking to candidates for a judgeship is a little bit different than that. But nonetheless, it was an interesting conversation between Republican Philip Regal and Independent Alex Treese. Some of the highlights of that conversation last night.
Mr. Regal, of course, currently serves as Hancock County Prosecuting Attorney. Mr. Treese currently serves as a public defender. I'd like to have you each explain how your experience in those distinctly opposite roles would shape your approach to the job of Common Pleas Court Judge. And we'll begin with Mr. Treese.
Well, what it's done is put me inside of a courtroom every single day. I take those experiences that I've gained prior to this position, traveling around, observing other judges throughout Northwest Ohio, being in front of Judge Routson for maybe even a little over a decade. And those experiences, because I'm in there every day, I know what is the most efficient way to run a courtroom. We're also very lucky in our community to have two great Common Pleas judges right now. So I've learned an immense amount from being in front of those two judges for a significant period of time. One of the main things I've learned from these judges and being in these courtrooms and dealing with these people is respect for anyone that appears in front of you. As a prosecutor, you don't get to talk to defendants. You deal with victims and you deal with witnesses, but you don't talk to defendants. When you talk to defendants, you have to sit with them on their worst day for something, some mistake they made or something bad that they did, and they have to, you know, face their consequences. It sort of changes your approach. It humanizes people. These are not cattle. Certainly there are bad people out there, but these are human beings that want to take oftentimes responsibility for a mistake that they made. So being a public defender, the vast majority of defendants are indigent and qualify for our services. So most of the defendants that appear in front of Judge Starnes' court are my clients.
And Mr. Regal.
So as prosecuting attorney, you make lots of different relationships, right? Work with law enforcement, and you see what they've gone through, what they go through on a daily basis. Some things are pretty tough. You work with them, you work with victims who've had horrific things happen to them. And so you sit with them and you try to go through, walk them through the process, because they don't understand. So you're trying to help them through that. You're trying to hold their hand. You're trying to talk to a victim and help them understand, you know, while they may want X or whatever sentence, that may not be what can happen, depending on the law and the circumstances around that thing. So sitting with victims, sitting with law enforcement, going through those things is really important and certainly helps shape who I am as a prosecutor. Talking with assistants and trying to talk through cases also has made given me different perspectives, listening to other attorneys and what they think is important. One of the things that I've also done as prosecutor is do most of our appeals. And so I read through transcripts after transcripts and try to deduce what the appellate attorney opposite me is trying to argue, and then also do research. So those are all things that are important. I do the research. I work on the appeals myself. I do this. I don't farm that out. And so all those things are important. But also as prosecutor, there's other things that are involved too. It's not just criminal law. Working with townships, working with our county agencies, that's also really important. And it also gives perspective. It gives a different perspective of what the job of Common Pleas Court, but also in this case, county prosecutor, means to our community. And those things, I believe, give me a good view of where what a Common Pleas Court judge should do.
Describe an ethical or moral dilemma that you have faced, either personally or professionally, and how you resolved it. And we'll begin with Mr. Regal.
Well, I think, I don't know about an ethical or moral dilemma, I think we always face tough choices as a prosecutor. What is the most appropriate offense to charge this person with? You read a report, sometimes a report is just kind of black and white, and it's hard to know exactly what's more in that. And so sometimes you have to go and you have to talk to officers, you got to talk to a victim, those sorts of things, and I've done those things. And so while it's not exactly the same thing, I think that those things are really important. Where do you get your information? Who do you talk to? And I think that's something that I've done as prosecutor. Again, sitting down with an officer and saying, hey, I'm not understanding this. Help me out. Help me figure out why you think this is this and I'm not quite there. And or a victim is saying, help me understand, how serious this was. And getting that person across from the table, looking at them in the eye, and then coming down and trying to make the call. What is this case? Is this the highest level offense? Is this, kind of applying this to, is this in homicide cases? Is this a murder case? Is this a voluntary manslaughter case? Is this an involuntary manslaughter case? And so trying to make those decisions can weigh a lot on somebody, because you want to be fair, but you want to make sure that you've also done the things that you need to do, and that you're protecting the community. You're also a voice for the victim. So I think that would be a similar type of process for those sorts of things. That in those type of situations, and in these types of campaigns, judicial rules are different. I know who to go to. I know who to ask. I know who to call the Board of Professional Conduct, say, hey, is this okay? And have those discussions to make sure that the decisions I make are appropriate and ethical and the right decisions for the community.
Mr. Treese.
I'll give you an example of where my morals and my ethics were sort of at odds. Earlier this year, I got a not guilty from the in a case tried by one of Mr. Regal's assistants that maybe I shouldn't have won. It was a minor case, and no one got hurt. It was a counterfeiting. Someone used a fake $100 bill. There was a piece of information that we all knew, that I shared, that if the jury had learned this piece of information, probably would have changed the outcome of that trial. Now, my morals are saying, this says this guy did this. Why am I fighting to keep this out? But my ethics are saying, I'm bound, I'm sworn to follow the Constitution. I'm sworn to follow our revised code, our rules of evidence. And so I fought to keep that piece of evidence out, and I got my not guilty. Now, that I use that as an example of sometimes we're bound and required to apply the law as it exists, maybe not even to not to change it, not to let our personal opinion sway us, so apply the law even if we may not like it. So I can assure you that's exactly what I will do when I'm elected judge, is that I will apply the law consistently, fairly, and ethically.
That was one of my favorite moments of the forum last night. It was a very interesting conversation back and forth between the two individuals who want to be the next Hancock County Common Pleas Court Judge, Philip Regal and Alex Treese, part of our forum, candidate forum last night at 50 North. And we thank 50 North for hosting. Thanks to the Findlay-Hancock County Chamber of Commerce for helping us present the forums. If you missed the forum, we also not only had it on air and online, we streamed the video of the forum on our Facebook page. And we have a link to that. It is archived on Facebook. And if you haven't seen it, you can go back and watch anytime on demand. We've got a link at goodmornings.net. And, of course, next Monday of next week, our second of two candidate forums featuring the candidates for the 83rd District House seat. That would be, of course, Ty Matthews and Sheila Caressel. So we'll talk. It'll be more of a traditional type of forum for that 83rd District House seat. And that will be Monday at 5 p.m. here on WFIN and, of course, streamed live online as well.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
This is the old Saturday Night Live routine. We're going to pump you up. A woman in South Carolina, learned the hard way that while getting pumped up at the gym, certainly has some solid benefits. Too much pumping up can be dangerous. Jessica Johnson, 25-year-old, said she took part in what is called the Murph Challenge. I'm not a big weightlifter, so I'm not familiar with this, but apparently the Murph Challenge is a cross-training routine that involves running a mile and completing a circuit of 300 squats, 200 push-ups, and 100 pull-ups before finishing up with another mile run. Now that is intense. That is intense. Ms. Johnson says the next day after she took part in the Murph Challenge, the next day she woke up with swollen arms, which you might expect, 300 squats, 200 push-ups, 100 pull-ups. She woke up with swollen arms, chalked it up to the fact that she hadn't done pull-ups in quite a while. The swelling, though, only increased over the next few days, and when her urine began turning an orange color, she decided that maybe it's time to go to the emergency room. And eventually, she lost feeling in her hands. That was the other thing. So, dude, orange urine, and she was losing feeling in her hands. So he's like, maybe I want to see the doctor about this. Tests revealed that Jessica had contracted a life-threatening condition known as rhabdomyolysis. It's where the muscles break down and release toxic chemicals into the bloodstream. Doctors reportedly had to cut her arms open to relieve the swelling. And she says she was lucky to escape the ordeal without, at a minimum, serious kidney damage. The lesson, she says, working out too much and doing too aggressive of a workout is not good for you and certainly not healthy. Wow. You don't have to tell me twice. I won't be doing the Murph Challenge myself anytime soon. Wow, that is crazy. Glad she's okay, but some scary moments there. Let's see. Elsewhere in the broken news here this morning. Now, we have a kind of an unwritten rule that when people die, we generally don't include that in the broken news because it's not funny. It's not funny when people die. But sometimes the circumstances are such that you just can't resist. This is just bizarre. A man is dead after a dispute over a jukebox in Florida. Police say it happened early Monday morning at a Mexican restaurant in Fort Lauderdale. Apparently, a fight broke out when one man apparently insulted another man over his choice of song that he played on the jukebox. And that, of course, is certainly justifiable, justifiable homicide, right? One guy pulled a gun, prompting the second person to pull a weapon of his own and open fire. First man was pronounced deceased. The suspect remains at large. Not sure whether it was the guy who chose the song who was killed or whether it was the other guy, but it was a fight over a jukebox. This is what we are coming to in this country. A fight over a jukebox. Not to be outdone. Now, here again is another deceased person in the broken news, which generally you find no humor in somebody losing their life, but sometimes there is some poetic justice. An armed robber is dead after his would-be victim turned around and shot him. Happened in Henderson, Nevada. You're talking about bad choices, you know? Turning to a life of crime just doesn't work out for some people. In Henderson, Nevada, early Saturday morning, a man walked up to a 33-year-old individual and demanded his cell phone and wallet at gunpoint. The would-be victim then pulled out a gun and shot the robber, leaving him dead at the scene. The the shooter stayed behind and cooperated with detectives. The case is classified as a homicide, but the shooter has not been charged. At least at this point, Henderson police say the robbery target was fearing for his life when he decided to open fire. So, I mean, he was being robbed at gunpoint, so you can understand. But talk about choosing the wrong victim. There you go. Choosing the wrong victim. Let's see. What else is going on here? Talking about choosing the wrong victim. This is crazy. Out of India, girl who was lured into an abandoned building by a grown man claims that she was saved by a group of monkeys. This true story. The child says that the man tried to force her into this abandoned building, and that's when the primates rushed toward the man after he attempted to assault her. Startled, as one would expect, the man ran off, and the girl immediately ran and told her parents. Her father says, "My daughter would have been maybe dead by now had the monkeys not intervened." The hero monkeys. Local police are now investigating the incident. No, they're trying to find out which monkeys they are so they can give them a medal. Wow! Monkeys to the rescue. And a couple of other items here in the broken news. This is a really cool story. The American Kennel Club says a wire-haired pointing griffon named Sadie has become the first dog to pass a 2-day hunting test while blind. Mike Adkins of Gross Isle Township, Michigan, is Sadie's owner, and he says she lost her eyes in a hunting accident 3 years ago. But after a few months, when she recovered from her injury, she showed that she could still hunt despite not being able to see. So he took her to Pennsylvania for the AKC's Junior Hunter Test, which actually consists of 4 tests over 2 days, and convinced the judges to let her give it a shot. Mr. Adkins says she is the first dog in the 128-year history of the American Kennel Club to pass the tests with no eyesight. That is all kinds of cool. Good for you, Sadie. You go, girl. That is pretty awesome. And not to be outdone, here is another amazing story with a happy ending. I don't know if you heard about this. A California man who was abducted in 1951 when he was 6 years old has been found alive and well. The Mercury News in San Jose reported that Luis Armando Albino has been located living on the East Coast. His niece took an online ancestry test that showed her DNA was a 22% match for a man who lived on the East Coast. I don't know exactly where, but someplace the East Coast of the country. She was basically a quarter percent match. After scouring old newspaper stories, the woman had a hunch that maybe the man could be her missing uncle. And she took those suspicions to law enforcement. Investigators were able to locate Mr. Albino back in June, and he was able to fly to California to reunite with his long-lost family, including his brother, who he hadn't seen since he was abducted at the age of 6. He took a DNA test. Sure enough, it matched. It is unclear whether there is an ongoing investigation in the case, but this dates back to 1951, so the possibility of sorting the whole thing out and, you know, what has happened in the intervening years, pretty slim, I would imagine. But wow, what a crazy happy ending. I mean, thank goodness a happy ending to that story, but wow, that is crazy. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Inclement weather, fog delays, and snow days. We all know what comes next. School delays and closings. When that happens, it's important that you get accurate information. We've got timely and reliable school delay and closing information presented by Blanchard Valley Health System and Chevrolet of Ottawa. The latest school delays and closings on the air at 1330 WFIN 95.5 FM and on demand anytime at WFIN.com.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. Where are America's worst drivers? In what state would you find America's worst drivers? A new survey of 5,000 American drivers. So they asked the drivers themselves. This was conducted by Talker Research for Forbes Advisor. And they asked about driving habits and, you know, best and worst driving skills. Overall, drivers in Hawaii were found to be the worst. But I thought this was kind of interesting. I mean, that's the worst overall. And apparently they know it. It's like 94% of drivers in Hawaii said that they were bad drivers. They admitted. Contrast that with drivers in Virginia. Now, drivers in Virginia in this survey, 99% of them said that they were the best in the country. And yet, they were ranked overall 14th worst. So, I'll take the Hawaiian drivers who know they're bad drivers versus the Virginia drivers who think they're good drivers, but really aren't. By the way, after Hawaii, Oregon and New Mexico, drivers in Oregon and New Mexico came in second and third place. And the states with the best driving behaviors, I thought this was kind of interesting. Tennessee was number one, ranked number one, best drivers in the country. Ohio, number two. Pat ourselves on the back. That's not too shabby. Ohio is number two. Pennsylvania and Florida came in third and fourth place. So what are our worst driving habits? Well, 39% of all Americans say that they have been guilty of speeding. 39% admit that they have got a bit of a lead foot. Now, that being said, only 14% admitted to driving 10 to 15 mile an hour over the speed limit. So most of us say, yeah, we speed, but just by a little bit. 29% say we eat behind the wheel. And I don't know, 29%, I would think that it'd be higher than that. I think we've all done that, munching on something behind the wheel. 22% admit that they have sped up while approaching a yellow light rather than slow down. Is it green means go, red means stop, yellow means floor it? Yeah. And of course, texting and driving. 22% of millennials admit that they have done that in the past month. 18% of Gen Zers. 11% of Gen Xers admit to texting and driving. Just 4% of boomers, though. So, and of course, this is probably not surprising. Overall, and again, asking the drivers, men feel that they are better drivers than women. We all think we're pretty good. 96% of men said that they were good drivers, 94% of women. And that's probably not a surprise that more men think that they're better drivers than women. That plays into that stereotype, right? But overall, Ohio, we can feel pretty good about where we are overall, second best drivers in the country. Hard to believe that we're talking about the month of October already, but it's a week away, and there are lots of ways to enjoy the autumn season with programs and activities in the Hancock Park District. Michelle Rumschlag is here to tell us what's happening. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
You ready for this change of season?
It is. Fall is my favorite.
It's fall my favorite. Is everyone's favorite. I mean, if you're over the age of like 12, I think.
Where you like summer?
Yeah. I think fall is everybody's favorite.
I don't like the heat, so I like the cooler weather and the leaf change, which is going to be a little this year with the dry weather.
So that's the prevailing thought that it's probably not going to be, you know, a
things
glorious
are just,
year.
I was at Oakwoods on Sunday for an open house and couldn't believe how brown everything is.
Yeah.
So you're getting some color change for sure starting. And usually in a couple of weeks, you know, mid-month, like, usually peak for us.
Yeah.
But things are just...
Yeah.
Adapting, it's not going to be as brilliant in the past.
So, in other words, just don't get your hopes up.
Exactly.
We're going to have a little bit of color, but don't get your hopes up.
Right. Okay. But, you know, it's what it is.
All right. It is what it is.
But it'll be nice and cool and...
Yeah.
And,
so,
yeah.
So, you've got a couple of things that are going on, highlights from the month of October.
Yes. So, starting this month, we are having our self-guided fall float trips.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that starts the weekend of October 19th and 20th. And so, with those, it's a little different. Still taking place on the Blanchard there at Zonta Landing at Riverside Park. But we need you to pre-register for that. So the floats take place at 1 o'clock. They're 1 to 3. It's like our special float option where you go upriver to the 568 bridge and come back.
Okay.
It's self-guided, so you're on your own. And we have the single canoe or single kayaks and canoes available. So that's the boats you can get. You get online. It's $10 for the kayak, $20 for the canoe with double occupancy. And you just have to sign up the Friday before. So if you want to go out that Sunday, you've got to sign up on Friday.
Okay.
It's not just to show up. We're not open like our normal summertime rentals.
Right.
And so that's going to take place again the 19th and 20th, the last week in the 26th and 27th, and then that first weekend in November. So only 3 weekends this year, just how the weekends fall.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we get 4 in there.
But that should be fun. I mean, the extent that we do have fall colors and the changing of the seasons.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it'll be really cooler. Cool. And, you know, I don't know why people go out in heat and kayak and be on the water. So, And still just, you know, a lovely time to get on the water. There's still going to be wildlife activity and things happening.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But I wanted to point that out. So, again, I mean, of course, everything's HancockParks.com, but you need to get on and register ahead of time via the website.
You mentioned a lot of wildlife, activity. This time of year, and easier to see it, too, when the leaves start changing.
Right, leaves are starting to drop, and so, you've got migration happening with your birds, and then, you know, everything else is getting ready for winter. You know, they're eating because they're going to be hibernating, growing thicker fur, storing food, so there's definitely still, like, activity happening outside.
That's not all. What else is going on in the month of October?
No. So excited that we're bringing back Autumn Fest at Lisenberg Memorial Woods. So we kind of paused last year because we thought the park was going to be closed for the repaving. And that happened this year. So if you haven't been out to Lisenberg, it's great. All the new paths, the new picnic tables. It's awesome out there. So take a look at that. We're going to be back out there on Saturday, October 19th. It's from 1 until 5. And some of the same things we've had, the McInnes House will be open, the workshop, we're going to have live animals, we're going to have music by Bob Ford, refreshments and activity barn, our plein air paint out will be taking place, so people will be kind of out and about in the parks and the areas, painting, drawing, sketching, which is kind of fun. It's free for the family, so, you know, bring the kids stuff. And with our new overflow parking that we've got out there, plenty of parking hopefully for everybody.
Yeah.
So love to have you come out.
Some terrific improvements at Lisenberg.
Oh, it is. And I think like the driveway and everything. I think it was a long time coming.
Especially this time of year. with the hiking out there in the woods and all of that, much easier to do, much more pleasant to do.
Yeah. So, Autumn Fest, Saturday, October 19th from 1 until 5.
Very good. Anything else to highlight for the month of October while we've got you here?
Well, things, we've got some Halloween-related activities kind of toward the end of the month like everybody else does. But one of them is going to be for families with children ages 6 and up, and that's Friday, October 25th. It's Howl at the Moon Night Hike. So you're gonna learn about wolves and coyotes and dogs and why they howl, and
why do they howl?
Conversation. I mean, they're talking to each other.
Okay.
While they're howling,
signaling to each other.
Yes, okay. I believe so.
All right.
I'm here.
I guess I need to come out and find out more.
I'm not the one doing this program. right, and so then we'll be talking about that, and then we'll take a hike afterwards. So we're going to meet in the activity barn at 6:30. Free. There's no registration necessary. We have a coyote call. So we're going to be actually playing it. We know coyotes are everywhere. We don't always just see them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm sure the kids, I can hear it now. All the kids will be howling. It'll be great. If you hear anything beyond their howling,
Halloween related at the end of the month?
On Sunday, October 27th, I'm doing an Animals of Halloween open house at the Discovery Center. They're Oakwoods Nature Preserve. It's from 1 until 4. Again, free, all ages welcome. So you think of those stereotypical animals when you think Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to learn about cats, crows, bats, spiders, owls, those types of things that you and some of them have a symbol and why they're tied. So we'll have some information on that, like why do we associate. Some I think are just because, like rats and spiders. Like
they seem spooky.
They're spooky.
Yeah.
People don't like them. They're not fans of some of those things. Obviously, they're important in the ecosystem.
Right.
You wonder why some of those things are around, but they do serve a purpose. So we'll learn about that, it'll just be kind of a fun. We got some craft stuff for the kids. So that's very Sunday, cool. October 27th, out at Oakwoods Nature Preserve.
Okay, so some of the highlights in the month of October. It's going to be a very busy month. We get into the autumn season, and there is more details about all of this stuff on the website, right?
Yes, HancockParks.com. So all of October and November is listed. And then kind of get a little closer to November, we'll start putting on our winter.
Look forward to that. We've got a link on our webpage for more info if you want to check that out online. And once again, Michelle Rumschlag with the Hancock Park District talking about all of the programs and activities in the month of October in the parks. Great time to get outdoors and explore. Michelle, thanks very much for dropping by.
Thanks for having me.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. And remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage, goodmornings.net. And coming up tomorrow on the program, Democrat Sheila Caressel will join us to talk about the challenge of running as the underdog in the race for the 83rd district seat in the Ohio House of Representatives. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.